then hair itself as a metaphor, which I think is probably why I use it again and again in my work. It's both the substance of hair, the materiality itself, but also it's the subject of hair. So the substance and the subject.
Coming up on In Contrast, The Art of Sonia Clark. I'm Ilan Stavans, and In Contrast is a production of New England Public Radio and Quixote Productions. Sonia Clark is an American artist of Afro-Caribbean heritage. She is a fiber artist known for using a variety of materials in her work, including human hair, to explore issues of race, culture, class, and history. Clark has exhibited around the world, and her work is in the collections of several U.S. museums. It is a pleasure to have you in Contrast. I want to start with you describing your hair.
My hair right now?
Please.
Oh, I'm so excited to tell you about my hair. My hair is the result of a recent project that I did at UMass in the University Museum Gallery. And I invited a hairdresser that I've known for several years in Richmond, Virginia. And I invited her to share her embodied knowledge with the audience. So this notion that a hairstyle, especially a pretty complexly braided hairstyle, which is one I have on my head, is the result of someone's learning. This particular artist and hairstylist that I was working with, Kamala Bhagat, everyone in her family is a drummer. So we often refer to the rhythm of a braid. It's like a kind of musicality on my head. It's a way of thinking of the cornrows on my head, the sculptural work that she's made out of my hair, as a kind of musical score. And in another sense, it's a record or an improvisation of something as well. Because she was inspired to give me the hairstyle that I'm wearing based on an African sculpture that was on display at the art gallery.
What kind of relationship do you have with your hair? Could you look back at the last couple of decades or more and reflect on the relationship between you and it?
Yeah, so that's interesting. You and it as if it's separate from me.
It's not.
Yeah, of course it's not separate from me. So we are our hair, but we are also more than our hair. In one sense, I think about my hair as being, well, it has our DNA. Everyone's hair has their DNA in it. So my hair is not only me, but it's bigger than me. It's my ancestors as well. But it's also very much me. So I think like a lot of African-American women, or perhaps even more broadly, women of African descent. And I'm going to keep this gendered in this way, not to leave the brothers out, but just because I've only been in this body. We all have a hair story. You know, when I was little, it was natural and in braids with baubles and barrettes and cornrows sometimes. And I grew up in Washington, D.C. And across the street from my family, my mother, my father, my older sister, and myself, was the ambassador from Dahomey, now the Republic of Benin, a small West African country, Yoruba people in terms of their ethnic group. And Ambassador Ajibade and his family of 14 had these girls who were older than we were, and they would do our hair in these sculptural hairstyles, not so different from the one that I'm wearing today. So there was a time in the 70s when I was growing up, I was walking around with these sculptures on my head, and I just knew that it was beautiful because people would stop me on the street and tell me that I was beautiful, and they really meant, your hair is beautiful. So that was a lovely thing to have as a young child. Also, I had a grandmother who every once in a while straightened my hair with a hot comb, you know, and that singe smell of burning hair and hoping she wasn't going to, you know, burn your neck. She's trying to straighten your hair in this sense of a kind of European aesthetic. A little older, I would get my hair processed, relaxed. I had to ask my father for permission because that was a financial proposition. Every 6 weeks, you're going to go to the hairstylist and get your hair relaxed, which is so funny, as if my hair were uptight. And then I came to Amherst College in the mid-80s, and there weren't a lot of people who were going to be able to help me do my hair here. And like many of us, we look to the models that are out in the world, whether they're celebrities or just whoever is there. And there's this wonderful, beautiful dancer by the name of Judith Jameson. And Judith Jameson had a kind of grace that I still only hope to possess. But she also was rocking a short, natural, closely cropped hair style. And she was an essence of beauty, Black women beauty for me, and also gave me permission to cut off that processed hair. And so for many, many years, if my hair was long enough to brush, it was too long. And fast forward to the first time that I went, no, not the first time, the second time that I went to West Africa. So I was in Ghana to give a lecture. Now I'm a young professor. I'm in Ghana to give a lecture at the Kwame Nkrumah University of Science and Technology in Kumasi. And someone pulled me to the side and they said, you know, you're a proper and grown woman and you're wearing the hairstyle of a little girl. Because there, it was only the little girls who had close-cropped naturals. You know, here Judith Jameson could wear that. And it's a sign of her beauty and her elegance and her sense of selfhood. But there, it was the sign of what a little girl would wear. So it was inappropriate. Mm. In Africa, I'm rocking my natural hair, and they're saying, actually, you're wearing a little girl's hairstyle.
So right? What was your reaction?
I knew about the contextual difference. Yeah. I understood about the contextual difference. But I do have to admit that not too long after that, I started growing my hair out and then came upon doing the project that I worked on with 12 different hairstylists called the Hair Craft Project. And invited them to do my hair in natural braided hairstyles that are actually more akin to the hairstyles that I actually had as a child. So this sort of reversal of what's culturally appropriate, we're all culturally connected, but what's culturally appropriate in one place or another. And those things shift, too. They shift across time. That's sort of the longer version of my hair story.
You talked a little bit about the gender. You said you're describing your view of your hair, obviously from a female perspective.
Yeah.
I wonder if we can go farther on that mm-hmm. and see the difference in Black culture between male and female hair from your perspective.
Mm. Again, I haven't been a man, so this is who I am. So sometimes people will say, your work is very gendered. And I guess it is. So taking on that challenge mm-hmm. as an artist, I was invited 2 years ago. April of 2016. So April is Poetry Month. And a friend of mine runs a poetry festival in Miami called Oh Miami. His name is Scott Cunningham. And Oh Miami's mission is short and sweet, to expose everyone in Miami-Dade County to a poem in the month of April. So one of the ways that he does this is he invites artists to come in and poets to come in, certainly, to try and help him with this mission. So he invited me, and I'm not a poet, but he invited me, and I said, okay, you know we're going to end up in a hair salon or a barber. And I actually said, we should do something in a barber shop. I'm usually doing something with hair salons. And so I stole an idea that I had seen elsewhere, and the idea was a barber, I believe in Chicago, who was giving free haircuts to any little boys who would read to him so that they would have this association between their education as commerce and a way of opening doors and opportunity. It wasn't quite what I was doing, but I liked the idea of people reading something in a barbershop. So I picked a poem by Calvin Herndon, the late Calvin Herndon, who was a professor at Oberlin College. And the poem is called The Distant Drum. And I invited gentlemen in two Black neighborhoods in Miami-Dade County, Little Haiti, which is Haitian, and Overtown, which is African-American. And these two barbershops, I invited gentlemen to read this poem, and they would get a free haircut for reading the poem. It's a beautiful poem, and it's actually one that I've embodied. I've memorized the poem myself because I thought it was such a beautiful poem. And it's actually about, though it was written in the 70s, it's a Black Lives Matter poem. It's about the African-American experience and violence that is enacted on our bodies and the history of that violence.
Do you have it?
I do have it in my mind.
Go for it.
Yeah, let me see if I can do this. So The Distant Drum by Calvin Herndon. I am not a metaphor or a symbol. This you hear is not the wind in the trees, nor a cat being maimed in the streets. I am being maimed in the street. It is I who weep, laugh, feel pain or joy. I speak this because I exist. These words are my words. My mouth speaks them. My hand writes. I am a poet. It is my fist you hear beating against your ear. I love that poem. It gets you into your own body. You know, you think about how we hear. It's actually a sense of touch, you know? And so your eardrum becomes the drum that is the distant drum. I mean, I don't mean to deconstruct it, but it's just such a beautiful thing.
The salons and the barbershops are curious places that are both public and private, and that particularly for ethnic groups, they play a major role.
Yeah. So there's this way in which a salon or a barbershop can be a place that you understand personhood and community. And they're all ages there. So you learn what's appropriate, what's inappropriate. You understand something about your own comportment. You also understand what might be important to the Black community at that time. You know, what people are talking about in terms of Black culture, American culture, global culture, what's fashionable, what's not fashionable. All of those things are being negotiated. And so it can be a place where you find something of yourself. And when those places don't exist, you can lose something of yourself as well. Some people will say between barbershops and hair salons and Black churches, you can understand a lot about African-American culture, certainly.
I can think of something similar regarding the Latino community, and I can think of the role of the dialogue between whoever's cutting the hair and whoever's hair is being cut, connecting with soccer or baseball or the politics of the moment or whoever slept with somebody else's husband or wife, and the entire community comes alive in the language that in and of itself will mix Spanish and English and other forms, and it's very symphonic.
Beautiful. And it also can be really gendered space as well.
Sure.
So when I had that short natural, one of the things that I would do is if I went to a salon, they were going to charge me about $30 or $40 more than if I went to a barber shop. And the barbers are cutting short hair all the time, so they've got a great skill and it's cheaper. But as soon as my female body would walk into that space, then I knew that it was changing the space, you know, that the
language, the dialogue, everything
course,
was different.
Everyone's like, okay, shut it down. There's a lady in the room.
Right.
You know, can't talk about our business. You know, this is gendered space. And then I'd leave and you imagine that it would just become whatever it was prior.
And it's more likely that something like you did would happen, meaning you entering a male space than a male entering a salon.
Yeah, unless there are spaces that are unisex.
Of course, we're here.
Yeah, but that is more likely. Though, of course, you know, gender is definitely mutable and in flux. So those things are not as hard-edged as they used to be. So there might be a guy who comes in, he gets his dreadlocks taken care of in a salon because this one person is known for being a really great loctician. That can go right across genders. That's not gendered space.
Yeah.
And there might be someone who's a gentleman who does get their hair processed, straightened, dyed, and all of that.
At what point did your hair become art? It's a beautiful description that you have just given me of looking at your own biography from the perspective of your hair. And of course, your hair plays a major role, and hair plays an important role in your art. And yet there must be some sort of moment in which from your head to another dimension of the world, there needed to be some sort of travel or negotiation.
First of all, let me just clarify that I think hairdressing is an art form. And that story that I told you of being a child, it was rooted in that. And so as an adult who now identifies as an artist, it's just to say, oh, let's remember that hairdressing is an art form.
Or continuing.
Yeah. Let's not lose sight of that. Let's amplify that. Let's have Kamala Bhagat and all the other 11 hairstylists I've worked with. Let's shed the spotlight on this tradition that has existed for so long and traveled across the Atlantic with us and becomes part of our space of culture and knowing. And it may go in and out of fashion, but it's still part of who we are. And in that way, it's not different than any other art form, especially any other crafted art form. I want to sort of focus on the craftedness of it in terms of, again, this kind of idea of an embodied knowledge. Mm-hmm. So when we're holding a ceramic cup, you're not just holding the handmade ceramic cup that you have in your hand. If you happen to know the potter who made that ceramic cup, then you're holding something of that artist. But you're also holding evidence of every cup that artist has made before. Right? So when Kamala does my hair, it's not just that she's doing my hair. There's evidence of every other head she's ever done before. And also every time she's had her hair done. And then my hair is connected to everybody else who's ever sat in a salon chair. It's sort of iterative that way and a connective thing. And then hair itself is a metaphor, which I think is probably why I use it again and again in my work. It's both the substance of hair, the materiality itself, but also it's the subject of hair. So the substance and the subject, the medium and the metaphor, both of those things, those parallels. A strand of hair itself contains our DNA. So it's both my individuality and all the people who got together to make me, but it's also a collective. So if I pluck one of your hairs and one of my hairs, and we just left them on the table, someone would make all these assumptions about our racial difference, right? Mm-hmm. Just by the texture of our hair. But if we dug in our DNA, we might be more related than someone who actually has hair that looks like mine. DNA brings us together. Hair brings us together, but it also can separate us.
Right. You were reciting that beautiful poem and talking about Black Lives Matter. And in your art, there is the individual and the collective, as you were mentioning. And there is also this other dimension that is the very contested term of the nation or the larger country to which we belong or from which we have been forced out or marginalized. Mm-hmm. You can use your hair in your art to question several symbols, flags, and others that are about how much of a presence or an absence do we have in all this. And I wonder if you can go a little farther with that idea of the very statement of Black Lives Matter is that our bodies don't count the same way and that we need to have them count the same way, that our Black bodies have been alienated and reduced in that it is time that the country wakes up and the whole debate that has been going on in the country is connected with the role that minorities and ethnic groups have had. Mm-hmm. Does the art that you have, you inject into it an attempt to bring forth a different consciousness in your viewer? You're aware of that while you're making the piece of art?
Well, I do hope that when I'm making a piece of work, there's always either a question that I have in mind or an articulation that I hope to impart. But I'd never know quite how it's going to land.
And do you have that articulation or that thought from the inception, or it comes forth as the work of art is taking shape?
Oh, that's a great question, Ilan. So sometimes artwork from beginning to end, I have a vision in my head and it lands in that same place. And other times, I have the privilege of being in dialogue with the artwork. And so one might say the muse is sitting there saying, nope, that's not a good idea. Or you thought we were going left, we're actually going right. And I can land in a place that surprises me. Sometimes it just feels like a gift. Like it feels like the muse says, here's an idea. Just do it. So it's not about dialogue. It feels like someone had dispensed a gift to me. I open it up and I say, oh, I've got to do something with that thing. So, you know, I was thinking about the idea of the presence of, or the definition of being an American. I'm first generation American. My parents are both from the Caribbean. My father, his family is from Trinidad. That's where he was born, but also in part from Barbados. And he's an ancestor now, but very much still with me in the everyday. And my mother, who is alive still, is from Jamaica. So there's a lens as a first-generation American, right? You know, I grew up in a Caribbean household. And if you know the Caribbean well, you know, people will say, oh, your father was Trinidadian, your mother is Jamaican. Were they still together? You know, like every island has its own, like, identity, sense of itself. Right. And, you know, so the Caribbean is not just one thing. everybody has a sense of themselves and their culture and their island. And
but you see yourself as an American.
Of course, I was born here. I get to be all those things. I get to be African. I get to be Scottish because of my great-grandfather. I get to be Jamaican. I get to be Trinidadian. I get to be Barbadian. I get to be all of those things. All of those people. Here I am, holding their DNA, trying to do justice by it.
Sunny, this is a question that I often have asked other artists that have been in the same seat that where you are. At what point do you see that the piece is finished, that is, you no longer have much else to do, that the channeling has taken place? And also, and along with that question, and I think you were already hinting at this answer, how do you react to the moment in which you think or you thought that you had the message or the inspiration, what you were talking about when you brought in the muses, and when the interpretation of a piece of art of yours is actually very different, and it could even be controversial because it is seen out of context or is seen in a totally different context, and can that unsettle you? To what extent are you still in control of that message when the work, if you deem it finished, is out of your hands?
Oh, I don't have control over that. I have control over what I say, but I don't have control over what the art says to someone else. The artwork starts in the hand of the artist, but it ends in the mind of the viewer. It's a little bit like speaking or witnessing a history. We're all in a room together. We're all going to see the thing, that experience, through our own lens. So I believe that's the same way with the art. And so one of the things that's helpful to me is when people read the artwork through lenses that are not quite what I had intended, but they ask questions about it. This reminded me of this. Were you intending to do this? This is what I see. Those actually are iterative. Again, they lead to the next body of work. So I love that dialogue,
right,
actually.
The continuity.
Even if it's very challenging dialogue. I mean, sometimes people will look at my work with Confederate battle flags and the folks who feel as if that work is an insult to their ancestry.
And so how do you react?
They'll deny my Americanness. They'll take things away from me. They'll say, well, what could you possibly know about the South as a first-generation American? What could you possibly know about that? As if slavery were not a global enterprise. It was a global enterprise. It is true that Richmond, Virginia, where I made my home for 12 years, was one of the largest slave ports in the world. It's also true that Christopher Columbus never landed on the mainland. So, you know, he landed in Jamaica. So, you know, when people start trying to take something away, discredit my identity, discredit my authorship and my voice, these are not new tactics. But as I'm interested in where those tactics, how they arise. It's the same old tactics.
Are there new responses that we have toward them?
Oh, I hope so. One would hope that we move forward. It doesn't stop me from making the work, certainly. I'm still always going to make the work that I feel called upon to make, and I believe that being an artist is a political act. I believe that empathy and ethics, those are the only reason that I teach, and they are also the reason that I make artwork. And empathy does not mean that we always agree. It means that we try to understand.
How about ethics?
In Richmond, Virginia, when I first moved there, there were Confederate battle flags that were hanging on the Virginia Museum of Fine Arts. And of course, this is a place as a visual artist, the Virginia Museum of Fine Arts, because everything is Confederate, has a Confederate history in Richmond, Virginia. So there was a Confederate soldiers' church, Confederate church that was there, a historical church, and it had a Confederate battle flag on it. It took a woman who was well-heeled, blonde-bobbed, wealthy woman in Richmond, Virginia, who was the president of the board of the Virginia Museum of Fine Arts, to say, it's not that that flag offends my friends who are Black, it's that it offends me. It offends me as well. I'm embarrassed by it, so it should come down. She used her power and her authority and privilege to get that flag down. And then came the people who said, we feel as if something has been taken away from us. You know, heritage, not hate. A small group of people started doing a little protest, having Confederate flags in front of the museum. Now, in response to all of that, just around the same time, the then Governor Bob McDonald, so that was in 2010, had made this proclamation that April was Confederate History Month. it's not a new proclamation, but he once again proclaimed as Confederate History Month, which, and this may surprise you, I don't mind that proclamation. What I mind is that in his proclamation, there was no mention of all the contributions that people of African descent have given to this nation free of charge and with much loss of life and trials and tribulations, right. Not to mention the indigenous people with mass genocide, like no mention of any of that. So I made a Confederate battle flag. I painted a canvas with a Confederate battle flag and then inserted the story that I felt that he had left out. And I inserted that story by stitching through the canvas with black cotton thread and then treating those threads as if they were hair on a scalp. So the Confederate battle flag is the scalp itself. And through that scalp are all these threads. And those threads then get cornrowed into the 13 stripes of the American flag, and then Bantu knotted. Imagine small chignon or small buns that make the 50 stars. So Bantu knots, referring both to a hairstyling technique, but also to language group. And then cornrows, also referring to hairdressing technique. Of course, in the Caribbean, they call it cane rows for sugar cane, but cornrows, cane rows, but referring to the labor of the land that makes up the American flag with this background of the Confederate battle flag. In one sense, one might say that's an empathetic act. That piece now belongs to the Virginia Museum of Fine Arts and is in the museum. So
one could say there's also a different approach or a different interpretation to this. Mm-hmm. So, and that is that whereas some want to keep the flag up and others want to bring the flag down, what you're saying is I want to have the flag itself reflect the history that has been silenced. Let's not disappear these monuments or these items that have become so controversial, but let's keep them embedded in them. Mm-hmm. We will have the history that has been silenced.
Yeah, so it's an interesting thing about the monuments, right? You know, all the monuments coming down and find out that they were so cheaply made and when they were made is fascinating. That mean old backlash. You just look at any forward progress for African Americans and people of African descent, brown and black people in this nation, and then you see this white rage and white backlash. I'm using the word white rage specifically to refer to the book, White Rage, which is a brilliant book by Carol Anderson. I've made another piece that it talks about this idea of monumentality, and I think about cloth as being a monument. Let me tell you what I mean by that. It's true that there are all these badly made bronze statues of different Confederate soldiers and generals, etc., especially in Richmond. Some of them were solidly made, but whatever. And you sort of have to know, like, which white guy on a horse is that, right? But after Dylann Roof committed that mass murder just outside of Charleston, South Carolina, of black people praying in a church, because he was so infected with this sickness and the racism that is so pervasive in this nation. Need someone to hate. So who are we going to hate? Let's hate the black people. You know, like, let's hate the LGBTQTI community. Let's find someone to hate. Let's put this rage somewhere. So we don't actually have to deal with, where is this rage coming from? Where is my privilege? Why do I feel like my privilege is being taken away? Well, this nation was built on privilege for white men in particular. And any time it's pushed against, then mean old backlash. So let's say we took down all these monuments. Dylann Roof, after he committed that heinous crime, there was this reaction. No more Confederate flags. You couldn't buy Confederate battle flags anywhere. I knew that wasn't going to last very long. The thing about Confederate battle flags is you could take them all down and still someone could draw one, paint one. So in one sense, there's this kind of monumentality around symbols that is more outlasting than a bronze sculpture.
What is your opinion on bringing down the statues? Do you think those statues better stay there as a reminder? You know, the part of the debate that says if we eliminate them, we're taking away the ugliness that they represent as well. Or do you think that it's better to cleanse the landscape of those symbols? The argument has been polarized within the two sides in both directions.
You know, I'm really of mixed mind about it. I think there are far too many. But I also, in the other side, I think that there's a way in which if they get removed, where do they get removed to? So that's one of the arguments about moving them into historical spaces so we don't forget them. Like, I do think that there should be a Confederate History Museum because we should not forget the Confederacy.
In other words, not destroyed, but moved.
Yeah, so that's one argument. I'm not landing on any of these, right, by the way. And I think it's really, really complicated. I think there's another way of saying, okay, let's contextualize them. So here's this history that's being told about a war that was lost, and the warriors that lost that war are being celebrated. What were they fighting for? So let's just have some text about what this war was really about. What are we celebrating? So that's contextualizing them without, right, necessarily moving them. These are all possible ways. And I don't have a hard line on it, actually.
I'm thinking also of, because I was part of that debate when it happened, of how the memory of the Holocaust has been transformed, mm-hmm, in this country that was removed and guilty of not participating quick enough to stop the Holocaust, and the proliferation of Holocaust museums in the last 10, 20, 30 years. I'm myself Jewish and I'm involved in, mm-hmm, in some of that debate. And the degree to which suddenly those museums have become the place where you go to remember, whereas remembering should, yeah, take place anywhere, they have a monopoly on the images. And that there's a danger in that as well. The danger of architecturally or geographically putting everything that needs to be remembered in a house, and then you don't have to do it anywhere else.
And you don't experience that. Now, here's the thing. I do feel, as African-American woman in this nation, the historical legacy of social and racial injustice, and it's not something that I get to escape on any day and any level. It would be a rare day when I would say, oh, yeah, got through a whole day. I mean, I would have to not leave my house, not look at TV, no media. And even that, you know, you're sitting in your house and like, I wonder what workers provided all of the things, right, that made, I mean, it's impossible, right, not to live in the world and think about the world and the, and human beings, oh, we're so complex. We can be so wonderful and so atrocious at the same time. So that said,
do you think that all art has the responsibility to teach?
I think that art can teach. I'm going to say that I would like that my artwork be in dialogue with people, but the responsibility to teach,
is not that of the art. Is that,
well,
what you're saying?
Well, here's the thing. If I said yes to that question, mm-hmm, I would be demanding something from all artists. And I don't want to make that demand. I would make that demand of myself, maybe. What happens in my studio? And I also don't want to fall into the place of being didactic. You must learn this specific thing. It's like, no, I want you to be in conversation. Is art there for critical engagement? Yes. Does it reflect who we are? Yes. In that reflection, can it be a mirror to who we might be? Can we learn something when the mirror is reflecting who we are? Can it be a sponge so it absorbs us for the next generation to squeeze out a little bit and figure out what did we take in? What did we leave behind? Those are the kind of metaphors I use around art. That it must teach sounds a little finger waggy, a little bit too didactic, but that it can be a slick surface that can reflect us and we can look honestly in it and see something of our ugliness and our simultaneous beauty. That it can absorb us so that the next generation can find something of who we are collectively across time and who we are in that present moment as opposed to in the future. Art can do those things, and I do think it should do those things, but I also think it can't help but do those things.
Beautiful. I am so happy that you've been in the show. Thank you for coming.
Oh, my pleasure, Ilan. Thank you so much for having me.
You describe your hair. What does it say about you? Looking at an old family photograph is an exercise in contrition. Perhaps more than anything else, more than the style of clothes, more than the objects that faithfully surround us, our hair is a statement of our age. Not only our personal age, that is, how old we are in a specific photo, but of our age, meaning the era to which we belong. The cut we wear or don't align us with those around us. But hair does much more. It gives us character. It distinguishes us in terms of group and generation and gender. Hair, along with nails, grows before we arrive to this world and it goes on growing after we die. Our hair contains our DNA. Our ancestors are inscribed in it, and our successors too. We shed it regularly, but we never shed our lineage. Sor Juana Inés de la Cruz, arguably the best female poet of the Spanish language, wrote at the end of the 17th century, in an autobiographical letter, that when she was young, she could almost hear her hair growing. She would measure that growth as a statement of intellectual prowess. If she couldn't study the works of Aristotle before the length reached her shoulders, she would cut it as punishment. There are also philosophers in antiquity who argued that the human brain was full of water and hair, and that crying allows one's hair to grow out as a way to cleanse the intellect. Hair is linked to ritual. Every morning in front of the mirror, we look for ways to give it form. Hair is erotic. Some religions hide it because it makes the instinct go wild. Hair is also used in forensic science. The criminal, in a single hair, leaves behind evidence of culpability. And hair is art. Think of Cleopatra, Abraham Lincoln, Princess Di, Leonardo da Vinci, Susan Sontag, Albert Einstein, Andy Warhol, the Beatles. In hair begins responsibility. Next time on In Contrast.
I start my work with ideas. I usually start with a theme, and I have multiple metaphysical questions that I want to answer, and then I create the planet afterward. I'm not a voice writer. I'm not an image writer. I don't start with, oh, I saw this person in a train and I wondered what happened. That's not me. So if it's not intellectually engaging to me, I don't want to write it. Also, I want to only write fiction, especially novels, with an omniscient narrator because I don't think I'm that interesting.
Minjin Lee on the next In Contrast. Let us know what you think about In Contrast. Review us on Apple Podcasts or send an email to radio@nepr.net. You can also follow us on Facebook, where we invite you to share your comments on this program and others in our series. Our interns are Delina Hatgu and Jacob Pagano. Our music is by the Fresh Cut Orchestra. The executive producer of In Contrast is John Vosey. I'm Ilan Stavans. Thank you for listening. In Contrast is a production of New England Public Radio and Quixote Productions.